I don't remember what the bit is today.
Wandering. Such a good start. What I suggested in the chat, in our little chat, that's not what you call DMs with just one person.
Chat, is it?
Hey, chat. Cool? Just talking to Adam. I said Brain Trust, the Brain Trust podcast, the wandering monster table of RPG podcasts.
All right.
You never know what you're going to get.
You turn the corner, and what is it you see? It's Adam and Will, the Brain Trust podcast, the wandering monsters of RPG podcasts.
This does mean that we have to make a reaction roll when we begin the podcast to see our demeanor. So let me go ahead.
Save for fear.
Yeah, let me roll it. Do you have any modifiers for today's reaction roll?
Plus coffees.
I just had a coffee too. So I
just took my first sip as you answered the phone.
I had a full iced coffee already.
So I guess this plus one.
I think that's plus three at least for me. Okay, let me roll it up. I'm down to one coffee a day.
I try to do that.
We got a plus two or three on that. I think plus two. So we rolled a 10 on 2d20 or 2d6. So that's really good.
Yeah.
We are so positively. Actually, you know, our reaction roll indicates that we might even be your friend today, which is great on this episode where we're talking about companions. But first, I want to know, before we get started, I want to let everybody know, we'll talk about this later, but we have a Ko-Fi that you can go check out. You can go to braintrust.rocks to find our Ko-Fi page and where to find everything about us. You can send us a few bucks every month. You can give us a one-time payment. We got cool stuff like a bonus episode. This month's bonus episode came out for everybody on the main feed, so I hope you enjoyed that. But otherwise, yeah, please go out there, and we'll talk about more of that later. What I want to know, Adam, is what the frick is up?
Baldur's Gate 3.
Baldman's Gate.
That is the only thing that is up. We talked about it a little bit on a previous episode, but it's just all consuming, and I mean that in that it consumes my time, it consumes my thoughts, it consumes my conversations now, because when I went to our chat to see what the intro was for the podcast this week, it's just us talking about characters.
Just Baldur's Gate. We're starting it a good 6 months after the game came out, which
is great.
Yeah, I
didn't even know that.
Because we can just enjoy it without having to be a part of the zeitgeist in any way. So it's really nice. It's good. I've played into Act 1. I'm pretty early, but I've explored a lot of Act 1.
I am 34 hours into my current play.
Yes.
And I think I did get it 2 weeks ago, so it is a troublesome amount of play. This week, also, my partner Alex started playing because she was just watching me, and she's like, this seems fun. So she rolled up a character and is doing a different sort of Moral Compass playthrough. And I'm there for when she goes, I don't know where to go, or who is this person?
Yeah. I got to ask, what class are you playing?
My character, Tav. Also, side
Tav.
Note, Tav is the pre-made name for your character. And I assumed in character creation that it was just going to give you a random fantasy name every time you created a character. And so I was like, wow, Tav, that kind of fit. I'm feeling that. And then I realized after looking online that everyone is Tav until you change it.
Tav.
But my Tav is a dark elf, a drow, warlock. And it's been really fun. I get Eldritch Blast. It's fun.
You get it now. Yeah, before, I'm playing a... everybody drumroll please, a human paladin. I'm not a cop, I promise. I just like the human paladin. Just love playing it. What is Alex playing?
She is a wood elf druid, which is already very different from my experience. I guess I would mention this is maybe a spoiler, a softest spoiler, is that you meet some druids in the early part of the game, and just the way that they treat her character is like entirely different than the way they treated my character. And just seeing it on display, like, you know, everything is going to be different depending on how you act and who you are and all that stuff. But like, I'm seeing it almost side by side, like very quick after I had that same experience. And it's so fascinating.
That's so cool. Seb is also playing a druid, but a gnome druid.
Nice. Can the gnomes go in the holes that you find?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll have to ask.
Because I keep finding them and like on perception tests or whatever, and I don't know what they're for.
Can't get into the hole. My thinking was I would have to convince a rat to do it for me.
Mm.
But maybe that's what halflings are.
As another fleeting thought about this game that I had this week, after realizing I'm 34 hours in, is I wonder what a speedrunner would do with this game.
Oh, you know what? Let me look up the speedrun
like any
time
percent.
Right now.
Because it's so...
I want you to guess what the any percent speed... So any percent speed runs means you finish it as fast as possible. Doesn't matter how much like extra content you complete. You like get to the end of the game.
Yeah, and I think generally that's with like some clever glitching and like loopholes, and that's its own game. Because obviously this game was designed to be the opposite of a speed run. Like, there's so much stuff. Do it as long as you want, right? But even just like the skill level of being able to confront a lot of these enemies, I think, I don't know, I'm guessing like 10 hours is any percent. But I'm not really familiar with speedruns, so there's gotta be a way to like break into it and be faster than that.
Yeah, okay, so I'm just going to blow your ass away and say the speedrun record is 3 minutes and 31 seconds. So,
oh my god.
You're a little off. I think there's probably some glitches there.
Oh, there's gotta be.
Let's see all acts. I think that's what we want to see all. That's held by May from Canada. Thank you, Canada. The all acts speedrun is 25 minutes.
Holy shit. Like, I don't understand that at all.
Yeah. There is also a category extension speedrun. So, like, they add some new fun categories, and they have sex percent, which is how soon you can fuck in the game.
Yeah.
And there's apparently there was a patch that made everybody less horny as it came out. And so the pre-horniness patch... it's literally 2 minutes. And then post-horniness patch, a terrible 5 minutes.
I might have to look some of these up on... not the sex ones specifically, but just any of the speedruns on YouTube and see what the hell is going on. Because that's like a completely different game. Speedrunners are playing their own game.
The big speedrun event is happening in January, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's like an optional Baldur's Gate incentive to play, because it's so big.
Yeah,
people would love it. Nice. Yeah, inspired by Baldur's Gate, we wanted to talk about an element of Baldur's Gate that's also a killer element of RPGs in general, and that is the companion. Now, what brain trust segment do we think this would be? Is it a new
thing? I think it's a tech lab. I'm gonna guess it's a tech lab. We're talking
tech
about
lab, yeah,
the mechanic, or I guess the like subsystem that is having a friend.
Friend system.
I'm just adding something that I want to talk about in the future.
Oh, cool.
Whenever
I don't even know what that word means that you just typed.
Whenever I open the spreadsheet, I am like, oh, I got an idea for the future.
Sick.
Yeah, I think this is a tech lab. Hit it with the song. We're in the lab, and we, late one night, when our eyes befell a friendly sight, a companion.
That's, the Monster Mash is just a group of companions. Okay, so what is a companion in RPGs?
To me, a companion is a character, okay, this is going to be hard, harder than I thought when I started talking. I was going to say a companion is a character that supplants the abilities of your player character. So you have your own like player character and you have a secondary character, and either mechanically or narratively or something, it has slightly less capacity than your main character. Like it is a DLC. It is an add-on. And this character either helps you accomplish things or otherwise like contributes to your ability to pursue your goals.
I like that definition. Yeah, I was thinking it was like an NPC, a reoccurring NPC. That kind of thing.
Yeah, so
this kind of like you know, there would be a featuring credit in the credits. Featuring Walton Goggins as the Goblin Man.
It's interesting because I think right away my expectation, or like, and it is heavily influenced by Baldur's Gate, is that I'm controlling, or there is some level of control to companionship. That makes them not an NPC exactly.
That's distinctive. So, like, you're controlling the companion, like, what they are doing in the mechanical part of the game, whether that's a fight or an investigation or something like that, a scene, but they are not voiced by you. I would say that that's the difference.
Yeah, so as sort of a few examples that off the top of the dome... Follow by Ben Robbins is a game where you're playing a character and also a companion for someone else. Imp of the Perverse by Nathan D. Paletta. I think you're someone else's summon or imp and also your own character. So there's like this duality. And I think this will put, if you have some more, you can throw them in. But one pin I want to put... Goddamn mailman. One thought I want to put a pin in is, I guess, the distinction or the supplanting. I want to talk about a hireling compared to a companion as well. But I'm just going to write that down and come back to it later.
Yeah, I like that. This is an old school concept, but... I think, like, I have designed a bunch of these for some 2024 games, and so I've done some research about what I like that games give me, what I like for myself. I find that when I'm playing a player-driven exploration adventure game, something like Plasmodix or something like that, I want to give them someone to hang out with. That goes around with the group.
Totally.
I find that games feel lonely until there is a companion. So I'm realizing in this conversation that it's kind of a core part of my GMing and my imagination of RPGs is that, you know, there's some people that want to kind of kick it with you for different reasons. So, yeah, what's your experience with, like... What's your taste for companions in games?
I don't know that I've ever played a game that explicitly has companion in that way. My long-running D&D game, we were a bard, a sorcerer, and a wizard. So RGM played a character, a GM PC, which is kind of, and he was a human fighter, so it was like, yeah, we need somebody up front. And that was a great game that was really well run and well played, but it served this function in game of like, we have three soft characters with no armor class and no real damage output, so we need just to cover that for the better, like the general sake of what this game does and excels at. So he was our friend in the game and in real life, but like, he as a GM resisted making really critical decisions. He would participate in conversation and stuff and in role play, but like still let us kind of steer the ship. And that was a really cool way of doing what was kind of a companion. And in that same way, like in the video gaming way, he had a quest that we had to help him find and do. And,
oh, that's
and then
fun.
We just had the GM like taking care of his stats and roles and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of strengths of companions. I have some rules that I've made for myself when designing these four games that the only way to communicate something about the world or a faction or some part of the lore of the game, it has to be through a human being. It has to be through like a character that has feelings and a relationship to the group. Otherwise, why would anyone care? So companions are great for that. So making companions be representative of like a faction in the game or an element of the world. So in Plasmodix, for example, Plasmodix comes with a setting called King Tide, where a tidal wave hits the city you live in all the time, and that's King Tide. And so your life is kind of dictated by the nautical charts, the lunar cycles, and all of the factions grow around this central world ender that this game has. And so all of the factions are related to this. One of the factions that we're playing with in my weekly game of Plasmodix is the Hermetics, and they are people that go explore the sealed places underground or that haven't been touched by the wave and collect all of the stuff from the old world. And so each player is hooked up into these factions, and because we had enough players in the Hermetics faction, I gave them a Hermetics companion who's a clone, who's a demolitions expert. I like this character a lot because she's a fresh clone that has, in a previous iteration, created secret handshakes with everybody that she is cool with. And so if she meets you, she'll start the secret handshake, and if you don't know it, she knows that you're not cool. So that's a character they have around and will react to the decisions and choices that the players make in regards to the factions, and they can leverage her skills and relationship to the faction to get certain things. So that's kind of my baseline strategy when designing these things. How do I communicate something about the world? How do I make people that need things from the players? I like to have just hangout companions, but ultimately the players are the focus of the story, so they're going to need something from them, finding out what that is.
That reminds me of a game that we designed on the show that never came out, Wastelanders, our kind of take on the Fallout 4 companion system, where the camera, the narrative lens of the game, kind of pivots and changes through the people that you meet. And you can follow these people on their own journeys because they have autonomy. They have...
Right.
Their own sort of sense of being without just being your companion. One project that I'd love to do, and I think now that the Brain Trust is asking for money on braintrust.rocks, is do almost like a little wiki or like a way of keeping tabs, maybe like a spreadsheet of here's all our old episodes and here are where we like designed X game. So you can go back and listen, because like I'm not going to find Wastelanders. it'll take me a couple hours to find it because of we just like didn't keep track of that stuff. But it's really cool, and it's a really I haven't thought about it in a while, but I think it was a really neat way of gamifying companions in kind of the opposite direction of what we're doing, like companion as autonomous being, rather than what we're talking about now, which is companion as this supplement for your own player group.
Yeah, an ensemble around the cast of characters.
Yeah. In
I like that.
In Cyber Metal, you have a contact, which I think is somewhere in between what you're describing, and, you know, other games have this too, but this is where my theory was, is this, we're not meeting in the tavern. Like, we're all knowing each other on some level, and we have been in this city for so long because it's an isolated city. It also comes from, you know, living in Grand Rapids for real, and everybody knows somebody. You have some friend in common or whatever. It's not the biggest place in the world. So there's 100 contacts in the book, and you roll a D100 to see who you've got. And it does simultaneously give you some backstory, some history. It gives you some sort of like obligation, usually in that sort of Electric Bastion Land kind of way, of like, not only do you know this person, but either they owe you something or you owe them something, so there's some forward momentum. And it also, yeah, just gives you someone to call or visit to make the city feel a little bit more alive and in motion. And yeah. I think that's a great function of companionship. Like you said, tying them to factions, is these people exist for adding social elements to the role-playing game, but also to root your characters in the setting. Whether that be through this kind of like human level understanding of the things going on politically or socially in your world, or just someone to commiserate with when you're shitty, when your world sucks.
Okay, now I'm going to reveal my companion magic trick for the Big Grave Quick Start. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay, so my favorite companion in any video game is Jackie Wells from Cyberpunk. Have you played this game?
I have not.
Okay, so let me describe to you the ultimate quick start experience that I am cribbing so much from for the Big Grave one, because I think it did such a great job. Jackie Wells is your contact in Night City. You get in some trouble, you cross him in some way, and you become fast friends, and you do a intro mission together after seeing like a year or two in montage of you hanging out, having a good time, doing things, getting in trouble, all of that stuff. He is like a giant fun dude who exemplifies someone like you in the cyberpunk setting who you can latch onto, and they characterize him so well. So he's like actually your friend. If you can find a playthrough of the first, you know, couple hours of Cyberpunk, just seeing this Jackie Wells thing is, it's so good for you. But in my game, Big Grave Fashion Fantasy, spoilers. The Cyberpunk, that intro section ends when Jackie Wells is killed in front of you, and then you're kind of left in the setting alone, and you have to pick up what happened. You're dealing with this loss, and you have to forge your own connections in Night City now. So it's this whole dramatic story tied into the first, you know, 90 minutes, hour to 90 minutes of this game, that is so successful, in my opinion. I think it's like the best start to any open world narrative video game.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it.
That's really clever, because you immediately have, again, momentum of like, you just watched your friend die, and so now you're actionable as a character. Like, you want to do things.
Yeah. And someone who you did organized crime with, you do like a mission with, and he helps you do the first mission. And so anyway, what does this have to do with Big Grave Fashion Fantasy? I'm in the process. It should be out, or I should have a date out for when Big Grave Fashion Fantasy, the Get Dressed edition, comes out. The Get Ready edition. Which is a quick start that teaches you how to play, gets you embedded and entangled into the world. And this word entangled is so important to my design with this thing. I want you to be inextricably tied to this world and invested in it by the end of the quick start. So the quick start is also a narrative entanglement. You are fully in. And this is a topic for another episode, but I now conceive of new games and new systems in what happens during the first session of that game. So the first session being a mandatory onboarding and entanglement that feeds toward how you play in this thing. Welcome to the new wave, everybody. Brain Trust 2.0. But so for Big Grave, you were living as a drone in this iconoclastic neon and pastel city called Big Grave. And the person who first made you feel like yourself, like a stylish individual, is this person called Bodhi Love. And you play this character creation, embedded character creation narrative section where Bodhi is getting to know and meeting each one of the player characters individually and giving them their first pieces of their first outfit. And the thing in Big Grave, it's a fashion-based role-playing game where you use your fashion in style showdowns against style rivals. And the difference between the icons and the regular people in the city is the icons, the players, have seen the weave of the world and know that there is power in aesthetics. And Bodhi is the person who showed them that. So you have this character who gives you all of your clothes, makes you feel like a cool individual, actually your friend. You have scenes that explain like how you got your essence, which is like your class, with Bodhi, and you forge an individual relationship with this person over the course of like an hour of this character creation onboarding, where you're learning like how to play the game, how these clothes work, how you use them as prompts to make outfits. And then Bodhi says, hey, I have an opportunity. There's this secret meeting that I need to go to, and I think you should come with me. I think you would really like it. And that is the secret meeting where you find out about the situation in the city and that there are these architects that are controlling different districts and making them into their personal like kingdoms and playgrounds. At the expense of everyone who lives there. So there are these, you know, strange god emperors, stylistic freaks that control these places. So you go to your first meeting and it goes bad, and Bodhi gets transformed by one of these architects who crashes the meeting into a normal version of Bodhi. So it's this heartbreaking death, basically, that Bodhi becomes just a normal guy. And that triggers this chase scene through the city where you end up confronting the architect and trying to save Bodhi. And that is the events of the first session, very inspired by the way Cyberpunk kind of embeds you into the city and into the systems of the game, trying to take those lessons and use them for my own dark deeds.
Yeah, in tying that in, Bodhi is your companion.
Yeah, Bodhi's a companion, and you try, and your companion is with you and is introducing you and entangling you in this world, and then something bad happens to Bodhi, and that's your first hook into adventuring in the city of Big Grave.
That also makes me think of, I mean, this is a stretch, but John Wick and thinking of like his dog as his companion.
Yeah. Right?
Like companions as these sort of catapults that push your character into a story. In all three of these examples, it's through tragedy, but I think that is going to light the biggest fire under a player's ass is something kind of devastating that makes them have to act, you know? And I think that's something we've talked about and think about too, is just like, you want that in all of your games, something that makes a player want to dive deeper or want to go into danger or whatever. Like, you need something, some spark. You don't just roll a character and be like, cool, so what do you guys want to do? You know, like, you have to have a push. And I think the bigger that push is, the more it pays off in terms of, like, character immersion and, like, player motivation, like just wanting to get in there and do the thing.
Yeah, I've called it the undeniable excuse for the player characters.
Yeah, that's great.
Like, you can't ignore this thing that happened to you. So you're ostracized by the end of the quick start. You're ostracized from the city. You have a full outfit given to you by someone who is in trouble in a way that you don't quite understand how to help them. This person has been normalified, so this person who had this very vibrant, interesting style is full corpo mode by the end. It's this, like, you know, massive turn. And that's your first hook into the, you know, how do we get more information? How do we find out where this person is? How do we pick up this rebel network across the city? How do we get powerful enough to even handle this? And it does something that I think RPGs sometimes really nail and sometimes are shaky on, which is, how do we make it feel very chill to also do side quests and side stories around this thing? That there's not such a ticking time bomb that...
Yeah,
takes up all of the air in a...
That's a good point.
In a quest.
Right, because the thing that... The time bomb's gone off already. The time bomb being, like, your friend dying or changing. That's the bomb explosion. And so you're then... You have, like, objectives that come from that, but you're still also just in the aftermath of it, so... There's less of a time pressure, I guess. So I like that because, yeah, side quests are where a lot of these games thrive and live, you know, especially in video games. Like, I know I try to do all the side quests because I wanted to, like, savor the game and not just, like, burn through it. So I think, yeah, the inciting incident of the game has happened, and you're going to always be dealing with that, while also, especially in the Big Grave example, like, you're having to, you can't just go to whatever Corpo HQ in Mission 1. Like, you have to figure out what that is and how to get there and who the players are and all that shit. So it's going to encourage that exploration and side quest kind of behavior to get to that point. I mean, to circle way back, that's kind of what I was saying too, of like the speed run of Baldur's Gate is like, I need to learn certain things and level up and do things to get to my goal, because otherwise my goal is unattainable. So it's encouraging that behavior as a player to take your time, I guess like the urgency is always there, but there's always going to be other things that are vying for your attention, and it gives you that duality of purpose and meandering.
Yeah, I've heard it referred to by Tim Rogers as like a section where it feels spiritually chill to go wander around. And I think designing, and this is something we'll talk about more on this podcast because it is like the main focus of my RPG development. But how do you make campaigns with ebbs and flows of these moments of like a time bomb? The Good Friends of Jackson Elias podcast called these bombs that you just have to deal with, interspersed with like space for exploration where it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm ignoring the things that my character would be worried about. In Cyberpunk, it's a really interesting counterexample because John Wick himself is stuck in your head and you have to get him out or you'll die. And so that is such a strong impetus for completing the main story that it actually makes side questing feel a little bit, what's the word? Like I'm cheating on my character. Oh. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because
it doesn't feel spiritually chill.
Yeah, because you're putting off this important task. That seems a little timely. It seems a little, important.
But anyway, that is like taking this idea of companions to the nth degree where you are essentializing companions in the story. And I think that is exactly why Baldur's Gate is so fascinating and so much fun. I think a lot of it is you have these companions that are often just fighting with each other. That's hilarious. I love that. And while doing some prep, I thought of some games and examples that do companions in an interesting way to build these kind of complex dramatic situations.
Love it. Let's hear some.
Yeah. Okay, so these are going to be from the more trad campaign adventures that I've read. But one example is the adventure Eternal Lies, which is a giant Cthulhu adventure where you are tracing something through history. Each NPC has notes on how to portray them that are like three adjectives that describe this NPC and how you would play them. And I really like that because if we made an NPC Mr. Lindor, I'm just looking at the Lindor chocolate on my desk, and said that he was gregarious, very angry, and sleepy, that would be enough that you could get pretty deep with that character before needing anything else.
Yeah. I like that sort of the adjective system or the sort of almost tags of NPCs that just give you enough like that. And still, I think there was something really important, like Mr. Lindor was, you know, a bomb-toting, I guess I shouldn't say this on a podcast, I was going to say the T word. we're going to get AI shadow banned. If he was...
You could just say unalive. That'll do it.
If he was going to destroy the moon, he was... That seems like a very important thing that supplants tags, right? Like,
yeah.
But for just like, sometimes I think about, this is a weird parallel, in Half-Baked, you have the guy on the couch and he is such a great NPC because he's stoned on the couch, mysterious, you know, like, and I guess like, soft-spoken would be like another important thing, because then if you're role-playing him, you know, like, yo, what's up, like, you can talk to him but he's not going to give you a lot of information because he's quiet and he's stoned and he's tired. Like, that's a, you know, a good qualifier for that character. And sure, you could go on to describe more, but like, then you're talking about economy of words and economy of thought of just like, especially I know you've been running more games and like experimenting more with like trad game play and what that means. So as a game master, you just have too much shit in your brain already. So yeah. I just want those couple things to get me moving, especially if that character is insignificant in the adventure design, not necessarily insignificant in play because the players will kind of dictate that, but like, yeah, just give me a stepping stone and I'll take it from here.
Yeah, and setting them on a track that puts them in the way of the party somehow, and or needing something from a particular person. And this transitions into the other tech element from another Pellegrin Press game called The Dracula Dossier, which is a big expansion for Knights Black Agents where you play people versus vampires. And The Dracula Dossier is like, hey, what if everything in Dracula was real? And so there's a book that's just filled with NPCs to get in your way. And something cool from there that you can steal are that there are three flavors for every NPC. There is a hot version, a cold version, and a cool version. They're called something else in the book, but that's kind of how I internalize them. There's a version that is outwardly hostile to the party that needs something right now from the party and will crash into them. There's a cold version that they are not like kind of the main quest giver in this element. They are acting more reticent or whatever of the party. You have like that relationship. And to me, the cool version is like that half-baked character who's kind of this hangout character that could be activated into either of these directions, but is currently in a more passive and ensemble role with the players.
I like that. I like that a lot. How does that come through in book? Because it seems like a lot more involved design and writing up front.
Okay, this is such a good point. So in Dracula Dossier, there are these... The book has tons of NPCs, but there's also, you know, missions and locations and events and all that stuff. And simply, the NPCs tie themselves to different events or involve themselves in these set pieces that already exist. So one easy way to do this for a smaller game that doesn't have as much page budget or development budget, stuff like this, is to, when you make a companion, give the GM a choice whether to have them be the hot version or the cold version. And the hot version is going to want something from the party right now. And for example, if you come across a companion, it could be, I would do anything for you to take me to this temple. It's a dangerous path. I can't make it alone. No one in my village can make it. You got to take me. I'm going to reward you because I know there's something at this temple that you don't. And so it becomes a companion who has an active need from the party and might even chill with the party for a while before they go, you know, like, okay, if you promise to go, we'll do it. Cause I just need to do this thing. And a cold version is someone who has that need, who isn't pushing it as far in the party or has a more nefarious version of that, which is maybe tricking the party or maybe forcing the party to do something, through violence or whatever it is.
I love it.
So that's a way in two sentences. You have like the sentence that is the hot version and then the cold version. And then you're giving the GM an option. So in this little style guide we have made right now, you've got the NPC, the companion. They have a name, they have a description, maybe they have some basic stats. Then you've got the hot version and then the cold version.
Yeah.
And then you're giving the GM like a method of... an option to approach with it.
Right, because I think... I mean, I like that. I wonder... I mean, I was going to say, are there characters who are only hot and only cold? And I think that's, one, super easy to dictate in that format. But two, kind of innately, the answer has to be no, because there's all... like, just the way that people play is going to be different. And as a designer... this is one of the things I hate about designing, is that... I can only write as much as I can write. Like, I can't plan for every possibility that a playgroup could enact. And I think that's cool, too. I said I hate it, but that's, like, because that's why I don't like designing adventures and campaigns, because, like, you know, best laid plans aren't... I don't remember the turn of phrase. You can plan a pretty picnic, but you can't predict the weather.
I like it. So yeah, I will. I'm gonna try and convert you over the course of this year, because I'm reading a lot of these big old books, and taking their best things from it and finding out how to do it in our methods with at our scale, how to make something like that. Because there are, these books want you to push at the edges of their things in these like really great sandboxy things. And there are really cool, we'll explore them in future episodes, but how to have these big, we'll call them like AAA adventure budgets and vibes on the most shoestring things. And I think having these companions are going to bring a vivaciousness and just a more vividly rendered world that's great. And so I think the last thing I'll mention is that for these companions, one thing that we love in video games is like the capstone quest that has like, okay, if you are super tight with this Mr. Lindor, he's going to need you to steal a blimp, and he's going to use the blimp to do something.
Go to the moon.
And yeah. And so say you are like, go to the moon and do stuff there. Make it into chocolate. Press the chocolate button on the moon. That's why Lindor chocolates are circles. It's because it's the moon.
I love this.
So say you just create, you know, a one-pager dungeon that is the, you know, point crawl of getting to the aerostat, getting in there, dealing with the people on board, and getting to the moon and dealing with the moon monkeys that live there. And you have a big capstone choice at the end that determines like what your relationship will be to Mr. Lindor after this mission has happened. After you've helped him, do you help him all the way, whatever, and then what the relationship looks like after. And it'd be killer if you could get a giant benefit from that, from investing this time. You have a guy with a moon base and an army of moon monkeys to help you.
Yeah, and if you like make Mr. Lindor your enemy, you're gonna have moon monkeys coming after you in the post story. Like there's consequence to your companionship. Like Mr. Lindor is taking the moon no matter what happens. You can be on his side, yeah, or you can not.
You can read about it or you can be there.
This is I think maybe sandbox is an important thing to talk about in the future, because this is, to me, I think you have a wisdom about how people actually play and how people actually use these texts to play, that I maybe deliberately leave in a blind spot, because to me a sandbox is saying like, here's eight cool things, go do whatever you want with them, I don't care what you do with them. Even like giving you a Power Ranger and not saying like, here's a Power Ranger, right? Like it's just, this is a human shape in a red suit and their face kind of looks like a dinosaur mouth or whatever. Like if you don't recognize it as Power Ranger, you're gonna do the sort of like, I don't know, hyper subjective, like, oh, this is like a mouth face guy and he's gonna eat you. Like this is such a weird example, but the idea being like,
I know what you mean now.
So hands off with what my I like designing pieces and saying have fun with my toys. And that, to me, is my design philosophy. And that, I think, truthfully, is why people don't play my games as much as other indie RPGs. Because in my mind, that's what I want. I want to look at UVG and say, this one thing interests me, but I'm not going to run the point crawl. And kind of build from there. I'm picking through the treasure chest at the dentist's office and saying, like, this one thing appeals to me and I'm going to take it. But you're six things from the dentist's treasure chest and saying, here's how these things are connected and here's what you would do with them. Like almost building a Rube Goldberg machine of story. And I think the momentum that that creates in play, you know, the undeniable excuse that happens over and over, not just session one, is what gets people to return to these games and play longer campaigns and be more invested in the sort of culture around games and like adventure design that I'm not participating in. I don't know if that is a true damnation of my publishing and design theory, or it's just something different. But I look at a game like Mothership, and I couldn't bounce off of it harder because the adventure design to me is so verbose and hard to wrap my brain around. But if you give me the one-page version of Mothership, if you give me a one-page space adventure game, I'm going to have more fun because I get to put my flavor, my spin on it, and I get to make it what I want it to be. And that's...
It can evolve in a way that you play like more improvised.
For sure. Exactly. I was just going to say, I am that loosey-goosey, yeah. And I like... That's where my fun comes from, is being unburdened and creative and imaginative with people and just saying, like, there's no limits, there's no structure, and anything we can come up with is going to happen. And I think that's cool. It's a different style of play, and I think that's why something like Necronautilus is fun for people. But I recognize the culture around gameplay doesn't operate in the same way. And I think sometimes my games, especially something more traditional like Cybermetal, is going to suffer by my either inability or unwillingness to adapt to those structures.
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear what you have to say next week after we play a Hex Crawl this weekend, and to see what you think and see it in action, because I feel like you have extremely honed narrative design chops that could be funneled into, you know, Cybermetal would be my pick for, like, if you were just to, you know, make a one-page adventure or campaign frame, which is like... A campaign frame is like a trad term for what is the idea of the player characters in this playthrough? What are they doing? So it could be Mormons in Cybermetal. Like, you could be the Cyber Mormons here against the world, or, you know, whatever it is. I think we were texting you about a Mr. Beast campaign, that Mr. Beast arrives in Cybermetal.
Every like cursed advertisement you see, you send to me, and I'm like, yeah, this is a Cybermetal campaign. I think
I sent you a billboard I saw the other day of the Bible app.
That's very forward in my mind in terms of like gameable. Would be really fun. Maybe we can kind of like theory craft that. The other one is, this is going to innately turn people away, but just doing a book called Animal Liberation is Human Liberation, and just go like full hard style vegan adventure zine where you destroy all the meat factories.
That's sick. Yeah. And like the sandbox delivery of it. So like, let's just say we had to pitch in 5 minutes, we have to pitch this scene. And so if I was designing the table of contents, I would have three factions, five locations, a companion for each faction, and then like two dungeons that represent a meat destroying scenario, or like best exemplify that stuff, and then a couple tools for what to do. And then the zine would start with a couple ways to connect these elements together to make like a spicy little sandbox, and then has just some stuff if you only want to run the abattoir dungeon or something like that.
I did frantically write this on a post-it because I think all of this stuff is things we're going to revisit as we continue that exploration into trad adventure design, into actionable game content. Like, it's funny, I think we did do this deliberately, but it's working better than expected. The sort of wrangling in of the Brain Trust podcast, where we say, like, we have ideas, we have things we want to talk about, we have frameworks around which we talk about them, which are like the tech lab or the therapy G or whatever. And just having that to hone ourselves, because I think we love, I guess, thinking of the podcast as sandbox and just grabbing onto whatever. But being more pointed, we get so much more done in the same amount of time. And so many, we're going to have this episode turned into four other episodes of things that we want to talk about, but kind of need to, because all of these are almost prerequisites to the sort of greater education that is campaign or game adventure design.
Yeah. This is BrainTrust 2.0. You're here for the ride. You can go find us at braintrust.rocks, where you can find our Ko-Fi, where we will have bonus episodes, cool extra stuff. Maybe we'll even have drafts of some games we designed on the podcast that we just simply can't make, Wastelanders, for example. Go there, go check it out. Adam, do you have got anything to plug it here at the end?
I do not. That's all.
Yeah, we're recording these in a big batch, so we're kind of just kicking it here. We have had more episodes in the last month than we have, I think, ever recorded. So
we're on a consistency we were when we were begging for Kickstarter money every week.
Yeah, when we were demand. Yeah, oh my God.
The dark ages.
Anyway, share this podcast with a friend. It really helps. Come hang out in the BrainTrust Discord, and we'll talk about it. And otherwise, we'll catch you next time on the BrainTrust podcast. Brain emoji, handshake emoji.